Hello, I'm Kenneth Couquier.
And I'm Francis
hey,
de
Hey, Ken, wait a minute. We're not doing it yet. Hang on. I'm going to cue you in.
We just saw a countdown. Sorry about
Flipping
that.
Flipping heck.
Okay. So, look, I'm always ready for action.
I'll cue you in.
No, actually, this is the door. Exactly. So let me get the pizza. Let me mollify the kids.
I'll wait. I'm going to pause. Don't worry.
Thank you. Okay.
Fancy bit of pizza.
Thanks, guys. It's margarita, and frankly, it looks like it looks appalling. It's so expensive.
The worse it looks, the better it is. We'll go again. Thank you for doing an impromptu rehearsal of the bit, but I will. I'll cue you in for that. Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to the Bokomi Club podcast. Now, every week, I ask people at the top of their industry or profession to pick a new non-fiction title from our monthly Most Wanted list. This week...
Hi, Bokomi. I'm Andy Bird. I am the CEO of Pearson PLC. And the book I want to read next is Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil. And I want to read the book because I really want to hear what the authors have to say about machine learning and human decision making. Today, we have immediate access to more data and more knowledge than ever before. And at Pearson, as the world's leading learning company, I really want to hear what we can do to make sure that we're always learning, always changing, and reframing the future with people in mind.
Thanks, Andy. And then, as you know, I interview the author or authors for our members to get original, memorable insights, or OMI, from the book, hence Bokomi.
Hello, Bokomi. I'm Kenneth Couquier.
And I'm Francis de Vreecourt.
We're the co-authors of Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil.
And this is our OMI for Bokomi.
Through his writing at The Economist, where he's senior editor, and his best-selling books, including Big Data, Kenneth Couquier is a world-renowned commentator on technology and business. Francis de Vreecourt is Professor of Management Science and the Director of the Center for Decisions, Models and Data at the European School of Management and Technology in Berlin.
In their book, co-written with Victor Meyer Schoenberger, Ken and Francis take the psychological concept of the framing effect, whereby our decisions are influenced by the way information is presented to us, and apply it to a new mental model, a third way beyond processed, artificial intelligence and raw impulsive emotion, which will, they claim, improve not only our lives as individuals, but the world at large. Ken and Francis, welcome to Bokomi.
Very happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks.
Now, you set the tone of the book in the opening pages with a quote from the young poet Amanda Gorman at the inauguration of President Joe Biden. This must have been a late decision. Who suggested it and why?
Oh, that's such a good question. And it was Victor, the third co-author, who's actually sadly not on the podcast right now. He was impassioned about it. He argued vociferously and adamantly that it had to be the epigram of the book. And the reason why is she said in three lines, the entire book. Now, allow me not to develop that more. I think I should let readers come to their own conclusion as to why he may have said that the entire book can be encapsulated in those three lines.
So here we are. Here it is in my best Amanda Gorman voice, which I don't have. For there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it. It is very much a book of the moment. You say ours is an age of division and paradoxes, but hasn't it always been the best and worst of times for philosophers and writers? They always think that their age is special. Why is ours different, and why does our decision-making have to change now, Francis?
Well, there are two things going on right now that we believe is very special, and it's very unique to our times. The first thing is the rise of AI, and technology has been always taking over many, many of human activities, but what is really new with AI is that it starts to take on some of our decision-making capabilities, and that is new. Like before, you could use a machine to replace or lack of physical powers, for instance, or help us to compute, like of course, like computers do. But what is really new with AI is that we slowly see more and more that it takes our ability to decide, and it does it on surface better than we do. So that's one pushes. Now, what's going on the other side is what we call the emotionalist. That is his tendency that we see with populisms to decide with the guts. And what is in many ways dangerous is to have this convergence, which is very unique to our times, to have the AI, the machines, and the populism, the emotionalist, joining forces sometimes, which put us in a very dangerous time.
We also are in a situation where, although every philosopher has looked at the world and seen strife, it's an environment in which we have failed to respond to global challenges for so long that these challenges that were small problems are now big, in fact, in some cases, existential challenges. Climate change being one obvious one, but American-Chinese tensions and a new Cold War is a second, and to say nothing of social justice issues that are tearing our, and political polarization that's tearing our lands apart, that together we see a failure to address problems that are of our own making. And that if we accept the fact, as technologists do, that we're in the quote-unquote second half of the chessboard, and that looks different, the metaphor being that when you're in a phase of exponential growth, that things that are doubling at 2, 4, 6 are very small, but then when you're doubling at a million and a billion scale, it substantively changes. We're in an environment where things are substantively changed, and we're in the process of that change. And unless we respond to it now, when there's still time to act, and I'm thinking here authoritarianism, populism, a lack of privacy because of the misuse of digital technologies, that unless we respond to it now, we're going to have a bigger price to pay in the future.
Well, we can get into the process that you describe so eloquently of framing a decision in a moment. But before anyone can do that, you point out that we need to choose the right frame of thought, the right frame of mind from a myriad of frames to tackle any problem at home or work or on the world stage. Does that mean those with a broader repertoire of models at their fingertips or in their mental framework are better at framing decisions?
Yeah, the answer is yes. And, you know, there is evidence, for instance, that we talk in the book. If you take American citizens who were born outside the US and come back in their home countries, those individuals typically are most successful. They have higher salaries, especially in occupations that requires thinking, innovations, good decision making. So we know that people who have been exposed to a larger diversity or variety of frames are better decision makers, more creative, and more successful.
Can you give examples in recent history where the right and the wrong frame has been applied to a new threat or opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, well, let's look at business. I mean, that's sort of like the most classic example. Business scholars are going to be wondering for generations, how is it possible that Nokia blew it? I mean, how just think about it. How is it that in the space of maybe 8 quarters, they went from being the dominant mobile phone handset supplier to a company that was teetering on bankruptcy? How do you do that? And the answer is, well, misframing. The problem is that what led them to their success all throughout the 90s and the beginning of the year 2000 actually turned out to be the very thing that was crushing them. At the outset, they took the mental frame of the telecom industry. That's an environment in which you, as the manufacturer, control every feature of the service, right? It's not the customer's decision to know what they need, right? You're selling largely just simply one product, and that is voice calls, right? It used to be charged by the minute, but then it was voice. And the very best thing that you could do was reliability. In every country around the world, the telecom operator was tied to the state. It was, in fact, an arm of the state in many places. It was run by the state. These were civil servants who ran it. And reliability was the most important thing, in the same way that the military or the healthcare service would have this. So what it meant is that features were not that important. What really mattered was the service delivered to the customer as it was defined by central headquarters, and what they thought people wanted was the cheapest thing possible. So Nokia was the largest handset maker for mobile phones, in part because they made really inexpensive ones that they sold into places like Africa and Asia for people who had never had a mobile phone before. The problem is that Apple is going to walk in, and their mental frame will not be the mobile phone industry. It will be the computer industry. And that looks radically different. The computer industry is typified, and that frame is typified by an environment in which you don't presume to know what your users want to do. You're simply giving them a general purpose device in which they can add their own features as they see fit based on the extensibility of software. It's inherently decentralized. Now, to be sure, the original App Store under Steve Jobs was going to be a centralized sort of system in which they could allow this flourishing cornucopia of software and apps, but they were going to actually determine what it was going to be in a much more hand-gripped way. They loosened that up. But the key result is that the Apple iPhone comes in and they reframe it. And as a result, people are now willing to spend, lo and behold, $1,000 for a phone and apps, and they don't want the cheapest thing, they want the most performing thing. And in fact, they crush all of their competitors by reframing what it is to be a mobile phone around the frame of the computing industry, release quick, allow it to be buggy, allow things to have mistakes, iterate and improve it over time with fast cycle times, not the mobile phone, you know, more sort of staid and polite and conservative approach.
What is a frame? It sounds to me like frame is just experience or learning from the past.
Well, a frame is a mental tool, if you want. I think the tool metaphor is a good one that highlights some aspect of the problems you're dealing with, and maybe more importantly, obfuscate some other detail that may be not relevant to help you draw new alternatives. What we like to say is to help you dream with constraints. So that is to help to guide your thinking process in a certain way that will help you see beyond the situations you're dealing with, and more importantly, to reveal maybe new courses of actions. So it's a very constrained way of imagining situations that guarantee to some extent that creativity matters in the world.
How have we framed COVID in the right way? I mean, different countries have framed the problem of COVID with different outcomes, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And in fact, you could actually look at the history of institutions' response to COVID as a question of either good framing or bad framing. The way that we explained it in the book is with a nice vignette between New Zealand and the United Kingdom. In the case of New Zealand, they never were hit by SARS. However, they were, because they're in the region where SARS was rampant, every time they rock up, their diplomats rock up to an ASEAN meeting, the large, you know, Asian, Southeast Asian association of countries, there's always going to be, you know, colloquiums and sort of diplomatic protocols and conversations about pandemics. So they're part of the idea flow on how to respond effectively. Countries that were hit had to change their health system very quickly, and more importantly, developed incredibly good surveillance systems and sentinel systems and protocols and policies of what to do at certain moments so that they could have quick circuit breakers and respond fast. So New Zealand watching this very famously at the outset, we saw Jacinda Ardern, the prime minister, say at a press conference to the country, we only have a handful of cases. She may have had 100 cases at the time, but she says, but so did Italy and Lombardy once. And this is at a time when people were watching on the nightly news, doctors weeping because they have to give people over 65 sedatives because they can't give them any care. And all they're trying to do is give them a dignified death. No treatment, right? So it was so terrifying that New Zealanders looking at this saw that, in fact, what she was saying was correct, that in an environment of uncertainty, to overreact is actually a smarter response rather than to underreact. This, by the way, is around the time when the British Prime Minister is boasting that he visited a hospital ward and shook hands with everyone there and wasn't wearing a mask and glorified, sort of rubbed the noses into the worry warts that this was anything but the common cold. In fact, the policy of Britain was not the sort of the mental model of SARS, but was of the seasonal flu. Now, by saying the seasonal flu, it makes it look like the case of the sniffles that people just with a bit of orange juice and rest can actually withstand. But if our mental model was not the flu, but say leukemia, right, we would treat it differently. right? We would have seen it in the severity that it is that's knocked out the global economy. So the mental model of Britain was the seasonal flu. The mental model of New Zealand was of SARS, and as a result, and of a true pandemic. And as a result, one country, New Zealand, responded very quickly, very dramatically, and by June, a few months later, was no longer in lockdown and was, you know, having rock concerts, while Britain had suffered one of the largest death tolls per capita in the world and has only just coming out of lockdown now, over a year later, after having made misstep after misstep.
When it's new, you do not know, and nobody knew with COVID how fast it will be propagating, what were the symptoms, etc., etc. So the only way we as humanity could act on it is to try to use the proper mental model and to project ourselves into the future, to try to interpret the data we had on it. A great, great example of that is, in fact, in 2014, which is the Ebola outbreak, which happened in Guinea. And at the beginning of, I think it was March 2014, you had two organizations on the ground. You had WHO and you had MSF, Doctors Without Borders. And both organizations had exactly the same data. And this tells you what framing does to you. They had exactly the same data. They had few data points, you know, only maybe 100 of cases and that's it. They had the same expertise, and yet both of them reached opposite conclusions. MSF wanted very, very dramatic actions. WHO said it's serious, but we can't control it. And the reason they reached different conclusion, even though they had the same data, the same expertise, is because they were bringing different mental model, different frame onto the situations. And that really illustrates why we need to be very good at framing, because if we take the wrong frame, we fail, like in fact WHO did. But if we take the right frame, we do something extraordinary, as MSF did, that is, only with very few data points, they can predict a huge outbreak just by looking at a couple of points. That's also the power of framing.
As you say, framing is the central quality of humans that is impossible for machines to emulate. That's your quote. Why doesn't machine learning lead to computers that can frame from an infinite range of models to get the best outcome? Is it because, as you say, only humans can imagine a scenario that never happened?
Well, that's exactly right. Think about it. The way that that machine learning, artificial AI more generally, but deep learning in particular, works is by looking at data and analyzing data. But what if there's no data to analyze? How else do you make a decision? Well, humans are actually extraordinary at thinking through situations in which they have no direct experience. In fact, we're the only animals that we know of that can actually do that. Whereas a machine, you know, a computer needs the data. It can't simply conjure it. I mean, it can try to conjure up things with which it has no quote unquote data for. It has to be programmed in. So in fact, a human being is there sort of behind the scenes, like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. But even if we were to try to do that, how would it apply the right constraints, right? It could go through maybe 1 trillion different potential counterfactuals in 9/10 of a second, but those wouldn't be the right ones. It's not good enough to go through n number of potentialities. What really matters in this world is coming up with the right one, the one that fits the moment that you're in. So machines really can't do that. Human beings are incredibly able to do that. In fact, it's the reason not only we're able to sort of take a shoe and use it as a hammer when it needs to be, because we reframe the purpose of what the shoe is for, but it also allows us to understand things that we don't have complete data to appreciate, such as, you know, heliocentrism versus geocentrism, right? It is possible to frame the Earth as the center of the universe, and you can even calculate planetary motions that way, but it's really complicated. But of course, you can also imagine it differently and reframe it as the Earth, you know, revolving around the sun. And of course, by doing that, it's just a question of framing, but humans can do that with very little data.
I remember reading a book about advertising 30 years ago by the copywriter Winston Fletcher, and he said that he longed for the freedom of a tight creative brief. And you make that point too with Frank Gehry and architecture, that we can come up with amazing ideas, fantastic ideas, even if, especially if we have boundaries and form and constraints all happening and conspiring at the same time. And that's the insight that I grasped onto in the book. All these things are happening at once. Was that an insight for you that boundaries and form are actually liberating?
Was it an insight? Sure, it was, but it was mostly the reaffirmation of a truism. It wasn't something that we didn't already know. In fact, I think a lot of creative people take it as second nature that they need that. A lot of people who are not particularly creative but think they are want to be without bounds and unrestrained. There's a wonderful repartee with Borges being interviewed. And the person asks Borges why he writes in the sonnet form, because the interviewer feels that it's much more easy to write in free verse. And Borges witheringly looks at the gent and says, "It may be easier to write, but it's probably harder to read." It's almost a truism among those people who are in the field and in the know that they need constraints. But the critical thing is the right constraints, the critical constraints that make a difference. Any form of constraint might not be appropriate, and it might lead to the right or suboptimal outcomes. If you focus on and actually deliberately play with certain constraints and the right constraints, you can actually create extraordinary things.
I fully agree. The presence of constraints and the necessary to have a constraint thinking to be creative is known by creative people. But the thing is, if you read business books, if you look at the daily life, people will often tell you to think outside the box, will often recommend that you leave those constraints behind. And this is very appealing because, yes, you can feel free to think whatever you want. The key point, I think, in the book is also that not only you need constraints, but you cannot think without constraint. If you try that, you can have crazy ideas, but it's not going to help you much. And there are studies that show that if you ask people to think outside the box, you induce this trying to think outside the box, they have poor ideas because they do not know how to proceed.
You're very clear that cognitive diversity, thinking from a range of perspectives and points of view, is key not only to a better future, but the survival of the human race. What examples are there in history where a lack of cognitive diversity, what you call maybe mental monocultures, has led to disaster? Isn't that what's happening now, where we're heading now with echo chambers and binary belief systems?
Well, that's the risk. And that was one of the motivations for writing the book. We saw what was going on and we were petrified that sort of mental monoculture, that homogeneity, cognitive homogeneity, was taking hold. I don't think it's there yet. In fact, if you look on Twitter, the last thing you think you see is homogeneity. You see a great, you know, cacophony of ideas and attitudes and views. But the direction of travel is happening in an obvious way. There's a ruthlessness of conformity of views and a casting out of those who don't conform. And it's far beyond what any individual person as an agent thinks is right. It's almost like a mob approach, but it's a mental mob. And so there's no one to blame. I think we're all sort of victims of this in the same way that if we're all going into Wembley Stadium and we're all trying to walk into the stands, that we're part of a flow, you know, whether we want to be part of it or not. That's just what we do. However, there have been cases in history in which mental monocultures have led to disaster. In our book, we talk about the tragedy of the Nazi period in Europe as one way in which the great flowering diversity that typified the Weimar Republic in between the war years started to winnow until eventually just one frame took over, and that was National Socialism. We also look at the story and economic history of China versus Europe, because, of course, by the time the Middle Ages is starting, a Martian in a spaceship looking at planet Earth would have no doubt who's the winner and who's the loser. China has the best science, has the best art, has the best economy, has the best civil service, has the best education system. And Europe's a bunch of barbarians. There's a couple of Franciscan monks in a monastery who are reading and occasionally writing, and everything else is just a barren wasteland of carnage. And within several hundred years, by the 1700s, that's going to totally change. And what it was China, with that was so hierarchical and centralized, made a wrong turn. They turned away from globalization and from science. They destroyed their ships. They They wasted their shipyards. They moved people inland to prevent the exchange of ideas. They wanted people to be very, and they created a country that was very insular. Whereas Europe, because it was both very separate, it was very fragmented, they were separate enough that people could experiment and do their own thing, but close enough that ideas were porous and they could exchange and find the best practices, that over time, they emerged to become the powerhouse that it was, in part because of economic and also military rivalry. And that helps explain the great gusto with which the European experience led to the Industrial Revolution and the Age of Enlightenment, and then, of course, would sort of lead itself to this greater mission, although it came with problems as well, and that the problem it came with was colonialism.
Do we have to accept all frames as equal to maintain diversity and progress?
The first thing that we really advocate is to say that there is no bad frame, there's bad framing. So there's the misapplication of frames to the wrong situation is what is hurting. But there's one exception to this rule, which is frames that exclude the existence of others, which is the Nazist regime, authoritarians, and that type of frames that will forbid any other frames to emerge. Why do we need to accept all frames? Because we do not know what the future holds. And we should be very careful to assume that all frames will save us, or the frame that I hold myself from my training, for what my experience, the one that I have accumulated, will help me solve all my problems, the one that I do not know yet. So for society and for humanity at large, it's extremely important that it maintains alive all sorts of frames, and these maintenance is called pluralism. You need to accept that within a society, you have diversities of frames that can clash, but they need, all of them need to exist, which means that we should not back off from conflict. I mean, at least intellectual conflict. I'm not talking about fighting each other. But yes, we need to accept the fact that it's sometimes difficult to have people who hold different frames on the same situations, but we need to give them the space in the society to have the right to hold those frames. The one we need to forbid is the one that forbid the others. So terrorism is an extreme version of his bad frame that we're talking about, because a terrorist is a framer, is a human being, is a framer, but his frame has lost any flexibility. It's only one frame, so there's no variety of repertoire of frames. It's applying in a very cold way, in many ways, the same frames to any situations. Typically, some of the, you know, causal templates behind it, maybe it's God who is deciding everything, deciding all my actions. And his frame is so rigid that when a terrorist sees other normal individuals who can have this flexibility of changing frames, they find it as immoral. Like the idea of changing your view depending on the situation is something that should not exist. So this is very clinical, almost, way of applying in a very rigid way a frame to any situations. And that's really one of the danger or the perversions of bad framing, basically. That's really an extreme example of where humanity can suffer from bad framing.
Can anyone be a better framer? What's your one piece of advice that our members can apply today, Ken?
We're going to need another hour. And the answer is a resounding yes. I think Francis and I both have several things that we'd want to say. But if there is one primordial way, it's just simply be aware that there are such a thing as frames. Be aware that we are that there are mental models, and that you can take what has long been a basic feature of cognition and turn it into a tool that can be deliberately used to see the world in a different way, increase the range of options or alternatives that are potential, that are possible, and to make better decisions.
Exposing yourself to frames of others, trying to understand what are the causal templates they are using, which constraint they apply, is a very good way to expand your own repertoire. You never know. Maybe you may disagree with these frames, but you never know. Maybe this is going to be useful to you in new situations. And we call that a cognitive foraging. In many ways, what you're doing right now with your wonderful platform, you interview authors and you give to your listeners many different representations of different problems. And so you help your listener to be exposed in many, many different ways of solving problems. And if I have to give one piece of advice, I'm not sure I'm the right person to do that, is to especially try to uncover the things we are not interested in. If you don't care about the Maya civilizations, for instance, most likely you do not know the frames those guys were using, for instance, to deal with the environment. So maybe just listening to one podcast on Bukami on the topic will help you give a sense about how do they represent it. And that may be helpful to you. You may think about it, oh, in these situations, maybe I can frame it that way. So expanding your repertoire frame, trying to have it as diverse as possible. You don't have to become a specialist in those frame, but trying to expand and have this curiosity to expand that repertoire is helping all of us, in fact, you and humanity as a whole.
It's easy to read. It's a very easy read for such a complex world that we live in and such a diverse range of thinking in the book. How do you go about completing a work like this together as a threesome? Are you like the Bee Gees? Does somebody do the harmony and somebody write the lyric or somebody do the guitar piece? How do you work?
You know, it's such a good question, and it's one that I get asked quite a bit. The best thing I can say is I don't know. And the reason why is it's like PTSD. I don't have any recollection of writing the book. I know I didn't see my family. They didn't see me. And I know that, you know, all throughout Christmas for about 10 days, I was sort of literally locked in a living room in which I slept there as well. I think that actually is a serious answer. But the other part of the answer is wastage. It doesn't look like this at the beginning. It looks like it at the end. And what I mean by that is we cut probably a third of the book out, right? We had, you know, 1,000 words on Alan Turing. We had 1,000 words on David Petraeus and counterintelligence. We had, you know, we had a large 1,000-word vignette on Creative Commons and Larry Lessig. None of this is in the book, right? It's to say that we took something that was big and a big mass, and like Michelangelo and marble, we pared it back and pared it back, and all three of us did until finally it was different. Francis had the core of the idea. Victor is a genius when it comes to the structure and the sense of what needs to be in it. And I'm not a bad writer. So all three of us together worked on it, but it's not like it was a third and a third and a third. It was 100%, 100%, and 100%, and it's a different book.
In the end, it's hard to recognize which part is from me, which part is from Victor, and which part is from Ken. What is very interesting, and it speaks to, I think, the book, is that in our own way, we were all coming up with our own repertoire of frames and very different. I mean, like between Ken and I, there's a world. I mean, we like each other as person, but our cognitive repertoires are very different. And so by confronting and modeling through, and as Ken discussed, describing different examples and going back and forth, it was a long, enjoyable, but at the same time, tiring and painful process.
Well, your pain is my pleasure, and I did pick up threads through the book, which I assume you all share and laid down together, which was one of a philosophical nature. You seem to be asking very clearly business leaders to understand the way that business has evolved as, you know, fearing risk and promoting efficiency, be that Taylorism or AI reducing risk in terms of learning and applying data to problems. And Ken, you know a little bit about big data as well. Are you asking leaders, business leaders and individuals to become philosophers?
It's hard to imagine that they got to, if they're truly leaders, they already are, right? You can't be a leader and not have a degree of introspection. And you certainly can't be a good leader and stay a leader unless you think with a philosophical mind. We might not call it philosophy, but that's exactly what's happening. And it's interesting that if you do read Petraeus or Colin Powell, or even Bob Iger and Ed Catmull, you know, great corporate leaders as well as military leaders and even political leaders, I think people are really struck by the degree to which it sounds philosophical. These people are deep, right? Managing And managing is different than leading, but both are hard. And unless you are of the bent of mind to try to see what isn't there, as what is it, Saint-Exupéry said in The Petit Prince, you know, what is essential is invisible to the eye. I'll let Francis say that. Ce qui est l'essentiel était invisible aux yeux. that was a poem.
You're good, my friend.
Oh, merci, mon ami. Okay.
I'll try that with a Yorkshire accent.
Fantastic. I think that we give too short shrift to the degree to which people who want to do great things in the world have to look at the universe and their place in it and think about it in a much more substantive way than we do when we're beguiled with the small talk. That is the superficial qualities of leadership.
I think it's true for good leaders. That's how you recognize good leaders. There's still a fascination for new technologies, for instance, to solve our problems. When you talk about global warming, when you talk about even, you know, AI is going to solve the problems. Even when you talked about at the beginning of the epidemics, they were all calling, wait for the vaccine, which is true, but many people died on the way. They were asking doctors to try to solve these problems. So the idea was always, we'll have the magic bullet, the magic technology sometime that is going to save us. Technology will surely play a role, but what we advocate in the book, and you're right, Rich, I mean, I'm glad you saw that thread, which is, in the end, it's your ability to develop the right representation of the problem and to create new alternative that we may not know yet. And obviously, we do not know it quite yet because we have not solved those challenges. But let us double down on what makes us good human thinkers, that is, on our ability to frame. And we talk, that's what we call the leaders to do more, but also society as a whole, to come up with better solutions, better framing for the problem. Because the answers are going to come from that. The answers are not going to come from the technology. The technology will help us, but the answers are going to come from our proper framing of the problem.
Kenneth Couquier and Francis de Vericourt, thanks for sharing your OMI with Bookomi today.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil is available to buy now in the Bookomi shop. Just follow the link in the description of this episode. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, that's you too, sign up to our monthly Most Wanted email at bookomi.com. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Thank you for listening. And remember, as Ken and Francis say, good framers are rare, but they can be found everywhere. Bye for now.